ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey there, Sana Qadar from All in the Mind here. If you're a true crime fan, you should check out our new series, Forensic. It's all about the psychological tools and tricks that are used to investigate crime. Want to hear more? Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Norman, I know you're on social media.
Am I? Yes. Well, I try not to be.
In some capacity.
Yeah.
Hashtag peptides. Have you encountered it?
I've tried to avoid it because as soon as I do that, it's going to come into my Instagram feed and I will see nothing else. The algorithm is going to hit me. So I know what I kind of know what's out there, but it's ugly.
I went peeking.
Oh, did you?
I went peeking and it is ugly. It's stuff marketed for anti-aging, gaining muscle. A lot of it's deeply seated in diet culture, give your pennies, big promises. And a recent study that's looked into this, it's pretty scary stuff with lots of potential harm and it's an unregulated Wild West out there.
That's coming up on the Health Report.
I'm Priya Alexander.
And I'm Norman Swan.
And for a change, we're both on Gadigal land.
Hi, Priya.
Hello. Also on the show, a study that has looked at Parkinson's disease and potential big differences when it comes to gender, how you present and the kind of symptoms you experience.
And indeed what might have been the risk factors associated with it, and some of them are quite surprising. Plus we're going to look at a cardiac treatment that you may not need. It's complicated, but we'll get through it. So what's the news?
First, we're starting with the Heart Foundation, which has launched its first clinical consensus statement on obesity and heart disease.
So this is in the era of our favourite drugs, GLP-1.
Yes.
Well, not necessarily favourite, but we talk about them all the time.
We do because there's a lot of, There's a lot of it about and a lot of emerging research. But these guidelines are really giving clinicians, health professionals, cardiologists guidance on management of heart disease in people living with overweight obesity.
And also prevention.
And prevention. But it is the first time that there's real clarity on the use of GLP-1 medications in the area.
And what do they say?
So they have said semaglutide, which people would know as Ozempic, should be considered for weight management in people who have established heart disease to reduce their risk.
So established heart disease means you've had angina or you've had a stent. Or
had a heart attack, yes.
Or stroke indeed.
They've said a GLP-1 with proven cardiovascular benefits, so that includes semaglutide or Ozempic, liraglutide or tirzepatide, which people would know as Mounjaro, should be considered in adults with type 2 diabetes to reduce heart disease.
So this is when you've got diabetes, which is a very high risk. So if you've got type 2 diabetes, your risk of a subsequent of a heart attack is almost the same as if you've had a previous heart attack.
Yes, so it's very high indeed. High risk. And then for people, adults living with heart failure, with their ejection fraction preserved, so you're still able to contract and get good blood flow out of the heart, they have suggested considering Ozempic or Mounjaro, semaglutide or tirzepatide to improve someone's symptoms and their functional capacity, so ability to exercise.
So this is the whole thing, that these drugs may have separate effects on the heart, independent of their effect on obesity and weight loss.
But I perused this with my GP hat on.
Mm-hmm. Is it ever off, by the way?
Well, sometimes. It's hard to take it off, to be honest. But the guideline, well, I found the document very useful because it really openly acknowledged things like weight stigma, inequities in the healthcare system. It also talked about the complexities of weight and the kind of relationship between excess fat tissue and how it impacts cardiac function. It was a really clear linking of these things. And whilst it's really good guidance, Norman, I thought some of this is still not implementable because of equity issues. It's still not on the PBS.
So in other words, if you don't have type 2 diabetes, you've got to pay for it out of your own pocket.
Yes. So access equity here is a real problem. So whilst it's nice to have the guidance, I know lots of patients of mine still won't be able to access it.
So we talk about a fair society, but those who've got the dough can reduce their cardiac risk further because they've got the money.
Yeah, which just widens the gap further and further.
It's not fair.
Good news, on RSV?
Yeah, respiratory syncytial virus vaccine. So this is the vaccine that is given to mothers.
Yes.
To protect them against respiratory syncytial virus, a nasty, or potentially nasty respiratory virus. But it's very nasty if babies get it and cause of hospitalisation and worse. And so there is a maternal vaccine available, which then protects the baby because of the antibodies going through to the placenta and also presumably through breast milk as well. Now, we have to say to start with, this paper has not been published yet. So this is a preprint. The results may change when it's been properly reviewed. But they're pretty impressive results in terms of protection.
The babies who were born to mothers who received the vaccine in pregnancy were 80% less likely to be admitted to hospital due to RSV. That is significant numbers. And worth just pointing out to people that this vaccine rollout happened early last year. We covered it on the health report. So it started in February 2025. And over that period, they've seen hospital admissions for newborns cut by almost half in its first year. So it's a successful program. For people who are pregnant or who are thinking about it, we give it to you any time from 28 weeks. And most of my patients, Norman, come in at 30 weeks for their whooping cough in one arm, RSV in the other.
And presumably influenza as well.
Yes. They've usually had influenza by then. We're getting influenza in the arm now, but you can have that at any gestation. But, you know, the timings do matter.
And interestingly, they also looked at, there's a monoclonal antibody drug which simulates the immune effects of the vaccine. So it's not a vaccine, but it simulates the vaccine. You give it to newborn babies. And these are babies before the vaccine was available to mothers, and they looked at the effectiveness of this monoclonal antibody. It's called nirsevimab, and it was very effective too.
Very effective.
Up to nearly 90% reduction in risk.
So babies get that if mum didn't get the vaccine in pregnancy, if the baby is high risk, or if mum got vaccinated and then gives birth less than 2 weeks later because there's not been time for the antibodies to cross the placenta and get to the baby. So some babies will get it, not all, and it depends on the state as well.
So good news there in terms of respiratory virus vaccine. And we just need to touch base with two infections which are roiling the world, or roiling Australia and the world. One is Ebola and the other is diphtheria. And I suppose I want to say, I'm going to editorialise here.
Mm.
We should be ashamed as a nation of this outbreak of diphtheria. And we look at Ebola in the Congo and in neighbouring Uganda, which has almost certainly been underreported. It could well turn out to be an incredibly nasty outbreak, or it may already be a nasty outbreak with this form of Ebola. And we can come back to that later. And it's no epidemic or pandemic in human history has occurred just because of the bug.
Mm.
It's the bug's interaction with the way we live, the way our lives are organised, the disruption to our environment. So you've got Ebola in a failed state where there's warfare, where they don't trust the government, and where the health services are woefully inadequate, not just because they might be inadequate anyway, but because health services can't get into that region. And also there's cultural aspects to that too, where people don't want to declare that somebody in their family has died and therefore there aren't proper burial practices and you come in contact with the body and you spread Ebola. Let's look at diphtheria.
Mm. A vaccine-preventable illness.
Words fail me
that
we have now, you know, depending on when you're listening to this episode of the health report, the numbers will almost certainly have gone up, but they were at nearly 200 as we talk now.
And in several states and impacting remote Aboriginal communities. I think just to go to your point, Dr. Matt Mason, who's from the University of Sunshine Coast, has said, "We must be honest, this is not simply a matter of individual vaccine hesitancy. It reflects decades of underinvestment in culturally appropriate community-led health infrastructure." So this is a failure. We've seen vaccination rates decline, particularly in childhood.
But these are people in their 20s.
Yes, the median age, yep.
Median age means that the age around which most people are getting infections is 26. Most of it is the skin version of diphtheria, but about a third of the cases are respiratory diphtheria, and that's what you can die of because you can get a blocked throat. It's worse in children than in adults because you've got a bigger throat, but you also get an inflammation of the heart And you know, that's why it is potentially fatal. But you get this from close contact with other people.
Overcrowding.
And almost every state and territory in Australia has inadequately invested in housing in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. Northern Territory is notorious. And I just heard the other day, you know, giving more money for Aboriginal housing in the Northern Territory. Northern Territory is wasting money on Aboriginal housing by building houses that are hot boxes, where there are alternative designs available, which are cheaper and more effective and cooler. So you get families crowding into one room with an expensive air conditioner where they can't afford the electricity, and you come in abnormal contact. We have created, as a nation, the environment for diphtheria to take off, and we should be ashamed of ourselves.
There's been criticism, to your point, of the Northern Territory health response, the fact that there hasn't been enough communication with the public, enough Aboriginal-led communication so that it's actually available to people in the community. They know what to do if they develop a sore throat, present early, be aware of vaccination as an option. There has been a lot of criticism, and look, this is a failure at many levels. And I think, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, we covered the fact that the World Health Organization had declared trachoma elimination in Australia. To this, the pendulum swinging completely the other way. This is a complete failure. I agree with you.
And if you listen to the two people who led the trachoma campaign, Professor Hugh Taylor, University of Melbourne, and the late Fred Hollows, they spoke about exactly the same conditions that produced trachoma, as we're seeing now all those years ago, but we've managed to prevent it, intervene, do something about it, significantly a medical response as well as environmental. But here you've got this ancient disease back.
Surging again. Just a reminder to everybody that diphtheria doses are on the schedule for children. They receive multiple doses, including one during adolescence. But for anyone who is aged 50, it's recommended that you get a booster. If you're travelling, Indonesia, Thailand, India, diphtheria is endemic in those countries. So in your travel consult, you should be asking, do I need a booster? So you might need to pay for it. I think it should be free if anyone's listening who has any clout. I think that we remove all barriers for people. But this is a story that must be watched closely. If you want to hear more about Ebola, we are doing a bonus episode just on that topic where we will do a deep dive and go into much more detail. That is available in the show notes or on the ABC Listen app.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. So Priya, now it's time for the word of the moment, peptides.
Yes.
It's just everywhere. Well, the chat is everywhere, but I think the peptides are everywhere too.
Both are everywhere. The hashtag is everywhere. They're being marketed for weight management, anti-aging, skin benefits, this looks maxing.
So every time we talk about peptides, people say, what are they? So is this your starter for 10 or do you want me to do that?
Oh, wow. So we're back to med school. I describe them as if you put together lots of little short chains, you make a peptide. There are some peptides people would know, like Ozempic or semaglutide or insulin.
And growth hormone.
Yes. What we're talking about, though, is these unregulated products that people can go and get from a website. Some health professionals are actually importing them and giving them to patients, and they're unregulated.
And if you want to know more about this, we have a Watch That Rash on peptides a few weeks ago, which you can tune into. And just to clarify further, so a peptide is like a very small protein. It's just a chain of the building blocks of proteins, amino acids. And many of these are on the poison schedule. They're taking, there's a copper-containing one. There's one that's supposed to heal muscles. Mm. The story we ran on What's That Rash was one called melanotan, which is used for tanning.
Yes.
So these peptides actually have real effects on the body. So this one interferes with melanocortin, which is a hormone, which does stimulate the cells in your skin to produce pigment. But it also has effects throughout the body, including the brain.
And it's not risk-free.
And there's been a review of the situation at the moment in The Lancet. And one of the authors is Tim Piotrkowski, who is an NHMRC fellow in the School of Public Health at the University of Queensland, which is really a word of warning and the state of the art at the moment. Welcome to the Health Report, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
So when you did this review, what's the evidence about who's taking peptides?
At the moment, we don't have any solid prevalence data. All we've got is proxy measures that we can rely on. So, for example, we know that as of May 2026, there is, I think, a couple hundred thousand posts on Instagram regarding peptides, and I think a couple hundred thousand videos on TikTok regarding peptides, which is a lot more than what there was last year. Other sort of proxy measures we have for us in Australia specifically is needle and syringe providers are seeing a huge influx in service provision for the equipment necessary to inject these substances, so much so that down the Gold Coast, there is needles and syringe providers that have seen a 600% increase in terms of the service provision from this year versus last year.
And just to explain, pretty much all these peptides have to be injected or put on the skin because they're destroyed in the stomach when you swallow them.
Correct. Yeah. Even topical application has not the best bioavailability. So you really do want to inject.
So Tim, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, the TGA, have in the last 2 weeks seized, they say, more than 900,000 units of unlawfully imported therapeutic goods. That includes things like nicotine pouches and these peptides that we're talking about. Are we really behind the eight ball when it comes to regulation in Australia? Like, how are people accessing these so readily when we don't even know what's in them?
So when we talk about the TGA, I guess they're our, you know, medicines or approved product regulation body. And so, you know, when it comes to peptides, like you would have heard and you mentioned earlier, you know, semaglutide, Ozempic, Mounjaro, tirzepatide, that's, you know, their bag. The peptides that we're talking about here are really either A, underground, we'll call them knockoffs of these substances. So they're made in and compounded in an unregulated manner and sold on, we'll call it, you know, online or through underground channels. And then we've also got all of the other wonderful injectable peptides that aren't necessarily on TGA's radar or anywhere near approval. So, for example, BPC-157, which is an interesting one. It was
For muscle healing.
Yes, it's used for recovery, so for increases collagen synthesis. That one was on their radar for a while, and I mean, I used just one example of, I guess, some of the peptides I've used in the past was BPC-157, probably more 13, 14 years ago. But it took until 2023 to put it on the Schedule 4 poisons list. And so if you can imagine, there's, you know, a lot of these that are popular at the moment. Some of them just haven't made it to even be scheduled. But I suppose, again, part of this responsibility falls on our, you know, regulatory bodies, but a large proportion falls on our ARPA registered friends.
Yeah, so just to explain that, I mean, I was confused about this to begin with, that a lot of these peptides have to be prescribed. And I thought, well, if they're going to be prescribed, assume then the TGA has approved them. But in fact, that's not true. What the TGA has done is they've put them on the poison schedule. And if something's on the poison schedule, then a doctor actually has to prescribe them for them to be legal. So there are a lot of doctors out there, presumably, prescribing stuff on the poison schedule.
Yes. And so I think, well, let's break this up even more, Norman. One, you've got people who are not seeking a prescription or even bothering with that pathway. They're just going to, you know, peptide.com.au, not a real site, by the way, and ordering, you know, whatever they'd like, and it's shipped to their door within, you know, a couple of days, and then using it based on
social influencers.
Information from their, yeah, influencers, mates, online forums, wherever.
How are the other people getting it?
So the other group, I guess, is those who have the means and the access to go and see a health professional. And commonly, I guess we call these, you know, anti-aging or TRT clinics. And you can go to these clinics and there is a means there for prescribers to, you know, well, the most popular one, obviously, is Ozempic or semaglutide, right? Being used off-label, so not for the, you know, intended indications, being diabetes, but for weight loss. And so they can, you know, go and prescribe that and off you go, you purchase it and you start injecting. Also, the ones that are on the poison schedule or, you know, not on the radar, that have been compounded and are prescribed. So things like GHKCU, BPC-157, of course, TB-500.
So I just want to get to what we know, because, you know, these are comfortable whether or not they're actually getting what they're getting when it arrives at the door. But these are substances with real effects on the body. I described melanotan and melanocortin issue earlier. And the risk is, if you are taking the real one, is that you might get an effect on your muscles, but there are off-target effects because you're affecting metabolism or hormone communication elsewhere in the body. But of course, there's also this enormous placebo effect. You're getting it through the mail. You've had to make the effort. You've got to buy a syringe. You've got to inject it. And your expectation of benefit is high. I mean, this is textbook placebo territory here. Just talk to us about what we know about the benefits versus the risks.
I mean, a lot of the let's use BPC-157 as the example. A lot of these substances don't have that level of evidence, and even for BPC, I wouldn't say that it was, you know, fantastic. Lots of preclinical stuff, and there's 3 human studies to date that were very, very much pilot studies. I guess outside of that, no. People are relying on animal studies with rodents usually. That said, I just do want to make a point that a lot of people, and perhaps this does relate to the placebo effect, a lot of people do order these and do express positive stories about how it's relieved their pain or they're feeling better or, you know, whatever else. And I think we'd be foolish to discount that completely. And really, just points to the fact that we need to gather the resources and interrogate this with robust research.
Now, of course, you don't know what's arriving in the mail. And you've done a study of steroids, in other words, muscle-building steroids, anabolic steroids, illicit steroid use in the gym, where you ask people to voluntarily send in what they got in the mail for the steroids to see what was there. What did you find in illicit steroids when it arrived in the mail for you?
So they actually had to bring them in to the service because sending them in the mail is illegal. But when they came in and dropped them off, we then had to cart them off for an analysis. We found that across 2 years of roid check, which is what the program was called, that less than 1 in 10 of the steroids submitted were the right steroid and the right dose. Of a subset that we tested, we found toxic heavy metals outside of permissible daily limits in almost all of those. So things like arsenic, lead, and cadmium.
So do we have a sense of peptides? So if they're tested, how many of those actually contain what they say they do?
So currently have a trial underway where we have people submitting and we are testing those results. I wish I could tell you, but I don't know yet. I'm waiting. We're waiting to see. I do have a feeling that if this is the same unregulated enhancement drug market as steroids, and so I do have a feeling that we're going to see something similar.
And Tim, just to be clear here, when you said compounded before, these peptides are compounded, it might not necessarily be in a chemist, the setting that we envision. It could be in someone's home, in a Thermomix, in any environment. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, sorry, I should have been clearer with that. So this isn't necessarily professional compounding. This is, done in.
It could be Norman in his kitchen.
It very much could be.
Okay.
You've been filming.
Scary stuff.
And on that, sorry to interrupt, but on that, a lot of these peptides come with claims around, you know, 99% purity or other things like this. Those also aren't tested in a, you know, regulated facility or in a public research facility like I had with RoidCheck. There was no chains of custody or oversight. And the way that they're being tested, the people involved, there is vested financial interests there. And so I find it difficult to trust the mechanism or the way that that's being done. And I think other people aren't necessarily savvy to that.
So coming back to that early question from Priya about regulation, I mean, our regulators are really failing us here. So doctors are prescribing this, and presumably APRA, the regulator for doctors, isn't doing very much about it, I assume. We don't know. And the TGA is putting on the poison schedule and relying on doctors not to prescribe them, but some are. I mean, this is a mess at the moment.
Well, I think APRA is also hamstrung in terms of the evidence available. But you're right, there needs to be a response. Number one, for those who are prescribing and where there is evidence there, there needs to be sufficient wraparound care for those people who are. So, for example, semaglutide or tirzepatide, there needs to be sufficient, really, partnership between allied health professionals around that wraparound care in terms of, you know, diet and exercise that goes along with these.
Tim, thank you for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
Dr. Tim Piotrkowski, who is an NHMRC fellow in the School of Public Health at the University of Queensland.
Just interestingly, Norman, I'm not prescribing the unregulated ones, which I don't know what the patient is getting.
I've made in my kitchen, yeah.
Yeah, that you've made, correct. So I think it is the Wild West. And I think if health professionals are putting hand on heart, writing a script for something which they don't know what the patient is getting, it lacks evidence, safety data, and you're not doing the wraparound care that Tim just mentioned, I think that's dangerous territory.
You're with the Health Report here on ABC Radio National.
Norman, Parkinson's disease, I think most people are aware of it. I think it's a movement disorder mainly, with tremor, rigidity, but it's actually quite complex. It can impact sleep, mood.
Affects the whole brain.
Yes.
Quite significant, and some people get very disabled by it.
Yes.
And have their on and off moments. Anyway, there's a project run out of Queensland Institute of Medical Research, which is looking at the genetics of Parkinson's disease, but also what the environmental exposures might be and what the differences are between men and women. So this is an interesting study, about 10,000 people, self-reported. So we'll explore just how valid that is when people report their own diagnosis. But really interesting differences between men and women in terms of the lead-up to being diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And the principal investigator on this study is Associate Professor Miguel Rentera from QMR Birkhofer in Brisbane. Welcome to the Health Report, Miguel.
Hello, Norman. Priya, thank you for the invitation. Happy to be here.
So did I screw all that up, Miguel, or did I get the description of your study pretty much right?
Yeah, you did an excellent job.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining. No, let's go further. So let's just summarize the findings here between men and women, because I find some of it was really fascinating.
Women experience more falls, more chronic pain. And before the diagnosis, they also experienced rigidity. They also reported more often than males that the symptoms started on only one side of the body, either the left or the right side.
Really?
On the other hand, men had more bradykinesia, which is slowness of movement before presenting the tremor. And they also experienced more cognitive decline, in some cases, even diagnosis of dementia. Depression and anxiety were also more common among women, and sleep disorders were more common among men.
What sort of sleep disorders?
We're talking about things like sleep apnea, in particular REM sleep behavior disorder. This is a disorder in which people act out their dreams.
So they lose the paralysis that normally goes along with REM sleep.
Yes, that's correct.
I noticed, Miguel, that there's this pesticide exposure, which excites Norman. Well, you're quite interested in it, Norman, I should say. But it appeared that men have higher rates or higher risk of Parkinson's disease, and they also tend to have higher rates of pesticide exposure. Is that enough to say that exposure to pesticides is what is actually causing Parkinson's disease?
Well, it is very important to establish that Parkinson's is neither 100% genetic or 100% the environment, and that there is no single cause to most Parkinson's cases. It is instead the cumulative effect of genes, environment, lifestyle, age, and it is extremely difficult to say that there is one single cause. Now, what we did see in the study is that exposure to some toxicants like pesticides or herbicides, or that people were reporting working on high-risk occupations, and this is, you know, in agriculture or welding, some petrochemicals, This is substantial and requires further investigation. So we're talking about 36% of participants being exposed to pesticides and herbicides, 33% having these high-risk occupations. And the other very interesting finding was major head injuries, like, you know, a hit to the head that involves losing consciousness. It was reported by 16% of participants. This is higher than the general population. And again, all we can say is that these characteristics are more common among people living with Parkinson's in the country. And this is in line with what has been reported in other countries as well.
I mean, the reason presumably that you asked about pesticides was that this is not the first study to show that. There's been repeated studies suggesting that some toxins may increase the risk of Parkinson's disease. So, I mean, given that you're now the nth study to show this, presumably it requires some more serious investigation, given that there are thousands of people in Australia exposed to this in their occupation.
Yeah, absolutely. Importantly, not all pesticides or herbicides are the same. And this is why we need to do more research and figure out exactly like who is susceptible to what, and also what are the mechanisms. Because, you know, being exposed one day for a few minutes is not the same as being exposed as part of your job over decades. We have some evidence about some pesticides or herbicides that is stronger than for others. So, yes, we definitely need to do more work in this field.
How reliable is the data, given that it's self-reported, people might be years down the track, that their memory of their symptoms, the onset might have changed over time? How much does that impact the story?
I think this is both a strength and a limitation of our study. It is a strength because it gives people living with a disease the opportunity to express how they live with it. And it is also a limitation because, you know, when you talk about a study that involves 10,000 participants, there's just no feasible way financially and logistically to perform detailed clinic-based assessments on every single participant. So at the moment, we are doing in a subset a study that involves telehealth assessments. And this is going to help us, you know, validate what people reported in the questionnaire versus what the observations from the clinicians would be.
Miguel, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Norman and Priya.
That's Associate Professor Miguel Renteria, who is a group leader in this neurogenomics group at Queensland Institute of Medical Research, Berghofer in Brisbane.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report.
So I really wanted to do this next story, Priya, because it's not often you hear a story, some research, where you actually don't need to do something.
Yes.
And as a consumer, you can say, do I really need that? And the specialist is going to say, well, no. And then you can say, if they say yes, you can refer them to the health report. So it's kind of a complicated story. Let's see if we get into it. And our interviewee in a moment, Professor Pras Sanders, is going to tell us whether we got it right or not. So we're talking about heart failure.
Yes.
And we're talking about heart failure, which is probably the commonest form of heart failure, where your left ventricle isn't pumping out quite as much blood as it should. And the other, and the heart gets larger, and you can get an arrhythmia in your upper chambers, atrial fibrillation. And you can also, because your ventricle is being stretched and damaged, be at risk of a potentially fatal arrhythmia called ventricular fibrillation. And they often put in a defibrillator into your chest, which can zap your chest if you go into VF.
It can synchronize things, but...
But...
Yes.
What cardiologists have also been doing is going in and fixing up the atrial fibrillation by burning around the pulmonary vein called ablation. We've done this many times on the Health Report, and we'll have some links to those stories in the past. And the question is, do you really need to do that ablation? Because anything you do extra is extra cost and extra potential risk.
And we should explain perhaps that by ablating that node, really what you're saying is to the device, you take over and we'll get rid of the body's system.
That's right.
Yes.
In other words, the theory was that the device could work, the defibrillation
would be more effective.
Could work better.
Yes.
So Professor Pras Sanders, who's director of the Centre for Heart Rhythm Disorders in Adelaide, what do we get out of 10 for our description of what's going on here?
Now, that's a fantastic description. I think the important thing, though, is there's two different types of ablation. One is to ablate the pulmonary veins to get normal rhythm, which really we should be trying to do in most people with heart failure because it's got a proven mortality benefit. But the second is where we damage the AV node, where we render the person dependent on the pacemaker. The thought there is really to say that we're going to allow the pacemaker to work more efficiently by ensuring that it's going to be pacing the heart and resynchronizing it.
And we should just explain, the AV node is if you like, our endogenous pacemaker in the heart. This is our natural pacemaker.
It's our natural electrical system that allows the top and bottom chambers to be coordinated in activity. And so the study that we did, really, because the data would suggest that in people with atrial fibrillation, unless you burnt the node, this therapy was being less effective. And so there was a push towards undertaking this AV node ablation and rendering people dependent on the pacemaker. And so that's where this study is hugely important, because it's a randomized study. And what it shows is that there's no difference between managing it medically or to ablate the AV node. And so this is a scenario where we now should not be ablating the AV node universally on everyone, but rather we need to judge which person would benefit the most from it.
So to clarify, what you're doing there by getting rid of the AV node is really cutting off the messaging between the top of the heart and the bottom of the heart, leaving the bottom of the heart to its own devices. What are the side effects of that long term?
The side effect is really that you make the person dependent on the pacemaker. So if anything goes wrong with the pacemaker, they're not going to have a backup. There's no nature's backup when the pacemaker gives way. So although it improves symptoms, it doesn't improve survival. It doesn't improve heart failure admissions. And it renders them without any rhythm if the pacemaker should fail or get infected.
So you halted the trial early because there was no difference in terms of worsening of heart failure or death. And you've just said this shouldn't be done routinely then. Do we have any sense of in whom AV node ablation is effective and required?
Yeah, so I think this is an area that we're going to need to study, but we need to get the heart rates down, because if the heart rates are going very fast, say over 120 beats a minute, then the person's not going to do too well in a compromised in heart failure situation. So we need to get the heart rate down. But the reality is, in most people, we can do this with medications. If we cannot do it with medications, then we ought to be thinking about, is this the person who's going to benefit from AV node ablation? In this study, we improved the amount of pacing, but we didn't improve any of the outcomes.
So bottom line here, because another reason we're talking about this is that heart failure is becoming much, much more common as we age. It's not just a side effect of coronary heart disease, it's also a side effect of aging, is that it's another question to ask your cardiologist if they want to get the zapper out.
Absolutely. Look, 2% of the population have heart failure and then 2% of the population have atrial fibrillation. This is a big deal and a very common scenario that lots of the listeners will be exposed to.
And just to correct, to go back to my error at the beginning, is that to treat the atrial fibrillation is different if you're just getting rid of the electrical conductivity around the pulmonary vein. That's treating the atrial fibrillation, but not disconnecting the top from the bottom.
That's exactly right. So the listeners should know, if your cardiologist feels they can get you back to normal rhythm by treating atrial fibrillation, they should go ahead, because there's good data to suggest that it improves heart failure outcomes and also the risk of dying.
Professor Prash Sanders is Director of the Centre for Heart Rhythm Disorders in Adelaide.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report.
What's in the mailbag?
Laura has written in and says, "Hi, in regard to your recent story about microplastics, if I understood this correctly, the tins that our canned vegetables come in have plastics in them, and obviously our frozen veggies come in plastic bags. Does this mean that we can only eat fresh veggies? This is so depressing for busy households. Are there any healthy, convenient veggies?"
This is close to your heart, Priya. Go for it.
Well,
first of all, you can get can. You can look at this can, and you get BPA-free lined cans. So there are cans that don't contain. I mean, what we're talking here is not necessarily the plastics themselves, but the chemicals that can leach out of the plastics. So cans, you can find cans increasingly, which are okay to use.
I think the lens that I have is that I'm a clinician. People ask me about this stuff all the time, Norman, and they go, what do I do? And these are people, Norman, who are often really busy and struggling to get in 2 serves of fruit, 5 serves of veggies, get enough physical activity in, reduce alcohol intake, potentially quit smoking and vaping.
All of which are more important than plastics.
Big fish to fry. And I say to people, you know what?
So you've said this before, you like fried fish.
I love. Yeah. Indians eat fried fish. You wait till you eat my mum's fried fish.
I can't wait.
It's the best.
I can't wait.
But I just feel like we have a lot of stuff to worry about. People have a lot on their plates. And if you said to me, Norman...
But it's about priorities. That's what you're saying.
Yes. So I think we need to be aware. We need more evidence in the area. What are the potential harms? Give me some cheap, logical alternatives because I love frozen and canned veg as a busy mum. And if you take them away from me,
and
Norman's
nutritionally, wrong. You know, snap frozen vegetables are just as good for you as fresh.
And the argument is it's probably already in the veggie anyway because there are microplastics and plastic-associated chemicals in the soil.
Yeah, just get over it. Do what's important.
Get over it. He's the one that makes us all anxious.
I have frozen vegetables and fruit in the fridge too.
There you go. Sue says, that was such a powerful segment. Tell me, are silicon containers any better than other plastics?
Supposedly. Yes. So I'm much more relaxed about silicone. Maybe
are
I shouldn't you? Be. Maybe I shouldn't be, but I am.
Writing to us if you're an expert in the area and if you think Norman is unduly relaxed. And Peter in Victoria says, Dear Norman and Priya.
This is blistering, this one. I'll keep my mouth shut on this
Do you
one.
Want me to read it?
Yeah, you read it. Read it as is.
Dear Norman and Priya.
We don't hold anything back.
Long-time listener, first-time emailer. I have been learning from the health report for many years and enjoy very much the banter between Norman and Priya and Tegan. Norman needs to be kept in check after all. I agree, Peter. I'm an experienced organic chemist and former chemistry lecturer and admittedly somewhat pedantic when it comes to the accurate use of language, especially when speaking about chemicals.
Now I'm getting nervous.
I listened with interest to your interview of Prof. Lucas and hearing about her team's excellent study on plastic-associated chemicals in the urine of people who had consumed food that had been in contact with plastics. Note that Prof. Lucas was careful to use the term plastic-associated chemicals, not microplastics. The chemicals her team analysed for are small molecules, not polymeric plastics. It was thus frustrating for me that the title of the segment is Reducing Exposure to Microplastics, and after hearing Prof. Lucas very carefully describe the chemicals of interest as plastic-associated chemicals, at the end of the segment, Norman again referred to microplastics. Sorry, Norman.
Yeah, you just got to keep me in check here. So look, fair point, Peter. Yes. That's why we've read out your response in detail. In my defence, so there's no defence because it wasn't a story about microplastics, so you're right. But to talk about the small particles of microplastics, there are concerns about the physical effects of those plastics. So what Michaela Lucas was looking at were, and we'll come back to her research no doubt later in the year when they're talking about the health effects, because at the moment there's no evidence one way or the other. But there are concerns about the small particles that you can get of microplastics environmentally. They get concentrated in the food chain, but also internally that they may get absorbed, may create inflammation in different parts of the body, such as the lung and the liver. So the microplastics themselves may well be a health effect, but absolutely right. What the West Australian team are looking at are plastic-associated chemicals.
Peter does say, otherwise keep up the excellent work.
Does he?
Yeah.
Oh, it's nice to be forgiven.
Please do write to us because we do read them out and we really enjoy them. Our address is healthreport@abc.net.au.
And our sister podcast, What's That Rash, this week looks at a growing market, the market for full-body MRIs. They can cost you $3,000, $3,500, and that might just be the beginning. Is it worth having?
Well, Kim Kardashian says yes, and I have great issues with it.
That's it. Automatically, I'm going to have it done.
No. I'll see you next week back on my home ground.
Good. Wurundjeri land.
Good.
I'll He's still be glad in Gadigal I won't. Land.
Yeah, you're glad. Okay.
No, it's been nice having you here on Gadigal land. You should come more often.
I will.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.